You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In the next hour, we'll be hearing from the experts on the year ahead in the Americas. No great surprise, top of the bill is the US presidential elections.
It is striking that you start out with 7, 8, 9 candidates and just one by one they're getting knocked out, rather like in a shooting gallery.
We'll be talking to a retail analyst in New York to hear what holiday sales mean for high street shoppers in 2012. And from the high street to high fashion, the catwalk expert Sarah Moore will be joining me in the studio to put us on trend for the rest of this year. Finally, we'll be joined by Tom Tivnan from The Bookseller. He'll be telling us what books he's finding unputdownable. All that, plus great music too, here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. So plenty ahead in the next 60 minutes. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world with Christian Yeo.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Christian Yeo. Several bomb blasts have killed as many as 70 people in Iraq. Officials say more than 40 were killed in a suicide attack in Nazariya, while several blasts claimed the lives of around 30 people in Baghdad. Meanwhile, an Australian man is being held hostage by a suspected Islamist militant group on the southern island of the Philippines and has appeared in a video saying his captors are seeking $2 million in ransom. Warren Rodwell, a retired soldier, looked pale and drawn in the video sent to his wife exactly 1 month since he was taken at gunpoint from his home in Ipil town. The footage was obtained by a local broadcaster. In it, he urges his family to find the required ransom.
To my family, please do whatever to raise the $2 million. They are asking for my release as soon as possible.
The leader of the Iraqi militia group, the Leagues of Righteousness, claims the kidnapped British bodyguard Alan McMenemy has been killed in a clash with his abductors. The group says it's willing to turn over his body now without conditions. McMenemy was kidnapped by Asab al-Haq, along with computer programmer Peter Moore and three other bodyguards in 2007. Moore was released in 2009, and the bodies of the three bodyguards were also returned. Two Britons and two Afghans have been detained for carrying dozens of AK-47 assault rifles in Kabul. Afghan police say they were found carrying the weapons in the east of the capital, near to several foreign military bases. Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui says the four men were also found to be carrying ammunition.
In our primary investigation, They were not able to provide us documentation. And most of these AK-47s, the serial numbers have been removed. So we consider this a crime, a very serious crime. And after primarily investigation, we handed over them to the Attorney General's office for further investigations.
As opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says her party has been approved to take part in the upcoming by-election. The democracy campaigner had been under detention for more than 15 years after coming into conflict with the ruling military regime. International Airlines Group, the company formed by the merger of BA and Iberia, has posted a strong rise in traffic last month. IAG said its first and business class travel, the most profitable part of its passenger business, rose 13.6%, whilst non-premium traffic was up 12%. And France's health minister is calling on the European Union to tighten rules on medical procedures after a scandal involving faulty breast implants. Many countries banned the products made by the now-defunct French company Polyimplant Prothesis, after more than 1,000 women in France suffered ruptures. Around 300,000 women across Europe and South America are believed to have received the implants. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Christian, thank you very much indeed. Now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel. And in Europe, the wind remains relentless across western and now central countries, causing some problems and damage too, delays at airports. Fresh snow is currently falling in the French and the Swiss Alps and will continue to do so through Friday. And the weather across the eastern Mediterranean is about to turn very wet, the Balkans and Greece especially. Snow here in the mountains too. So quite turbulent weather in Europe the next few days. Now Friday, city outlook, London 8 Celsius, partly cloudy, Hamburg 5 Celsius and sunny, and Sofia it's 3 with rain and snow, Lisbon 16 here with some sunshine. In North America, the US is just coming to the end of a cold snap, the coldest weather of the winter season so far. In Manhattan, the morning temperatures have been dropping down to minus 11 degrees. Florida has suffered from frosts too. Now it's becoming less cold in most major cities across the eastern US. If you're wondering about the Rockies, well, it looks mostly sunny in the coming days. Here's Friday's city outlook. In Toronto, 6 degrees, partly cloudy. Chicago and New York City, 8 Celsius now, and sunny in San Francisco, 15 degrees with some sunshine. And other world destinations for the next few days. And if you're heading to Cape Town, expect some very hot weather here. Over the weekend, highs up to 34 degrees with tons of sun. In Johannesburg, not quite as hot, about 28, but humid with a chance of thunderstorms. And staying in the southern hemisphere, Buenos Aires, also very hot. Temperatures here in the low to mid 30s. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
6 minutes past the hour here. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oikeassa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And we begin today's Midori House with a look ahead to 2012, because all this week, the first week of the year, Monocle 24 has been talking to academics, professionals and industry leaders about how the world might well look in the next 12 months. Continuing our global briefing series all this week, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield has spoken to the ABC News London correspondent Geoffrey Kaufman, the Professor of History at University College London Kathleen Burke, and Monocle's New York editor Aisha Spears. They discussed the year ahead in the Americas. Steve began by looking ahead to the story that's bound to dominate this year, the US presidential elections.
What's quite striking is that on the one hand, you have Obama just still. On the other hand, you have candidates bouncing up and down like on a trampoline. And one just doesn't know. The idea that can I be not precisely partisan, but slightly opinionated here, which is if Gingrich does turn out to be the candidate, that will celebrate the lack of memory in the American polity, I think, considering what he managed to do when he was in Congress, which was bring the federal government to a grinding halt. On the other hand, it's quite striking the anyone but Romney approach. I don't really understand it. I don't mind myself if chaps are boring, as long as they manage to accomplish things. But somehow this doesn't seem to be acceptable. I mean, it would also be quite nice if he stuck to one policy instead of wandering back and forth like a fan in front of a fan. But it is striking that you start out with 7, 8, 9 candidates and just one by one they're getting knocked out, rather like in a shooting gallery. What's going to happen? Well, Obama's going to be the Democratic candidate.
Good, right.
that I can count on. But if Gingrich is the other candidate, it will be one for the records, I think.
I think this is a race defined right now for the Republicans by instability. It's really fascinating for those of us who care to watch this stuff. This is something that no one can write this script. And in fact, I think it's fair to say there are a lot of anxious Republicans who thought that given the economy, given Obama's strengths and weaknesses, his weaknesses in particular, that they had a very good shot at recapturing the White House. And it may be that Obama's best chance of winning a second term is the Republican opposition, because right now it's very clear that Republicans aren't really thrilled with any of the options they have. And let's face it, Republicans need to galvanize their base come election time around, and they've got to mobilize around the candidate. And right now, as Kathy points out, there is a real ambiguity, a real uncertainty around Romney, who's been the front runner. But it's as if they're kind of holding their nose and they're like some sort of smelly dish rag at holding him. With the two fingers away from them. Well, if we have to, we'll use this, but we really don't want to. And they've flirted with all these other people. I mean, with Donald Trump, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, and Rick Perry. I mean, the list, it's really incredible when you think about it. It's been Romney and it's been this kind of, it's been a two-man race or a two-person race since May.
You've got much more fragmentation. I mean, as we both remember, perhaps, there is the Tea Party, which is an ideological right, of course, of quite stunning strength. But remember in the 60s, you had an ideological left that also drove a president out. As you can remember, Lyndon Johnson wouldn't rerun. But they were more unified. In fact, there was perhaps too big. There was either you're for the, you didn't care, you were for the war, or you were against it. But the Republicans, I mean, nowadays we all watch the Tea Party in some bemusement, I think. But, and what you get there, as you quite rightly said, Jeffrey, is fragmentation.
A year of fragmentation ahead then. That was Jeffrey Kaufman, Kathleen Burke and Aisha Spears all talking to Monocle's editor Steve Bloomfield. And I'm very happy to say that Steve is back in the studio again for us today on the Midori House. Hello, Steve. That piece was very much on the tussle between the Republicans and all trying to beat Obama, because he is the man to beat this year, isn't he? No matter how bad he gets in the next 9 months or how unpopular it is. It was Jeffrey Kaufman who made the very good point that basically it's the Republicans' weakness that may well just lose them the election.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at Obama's record, the fact that unemployment is more than 8%, the economy is still in trouble, this should be very fertile ground for the Republicans. But their candidates are all, with the exception of Romney and Huntsman, a little bit wacky. In their own special ways.
And Romney has his own particularities.
Romney has his own
A fan in front of a fan.
Yeah.
Is how it was described just then.
There's some very good... when John McCain yesterday came out in support of Mitt Romney, someone sent around an old video that John McCain had put out 4 years ago when he was running against Mitt Romney, which summed up the case against Romney very well. It showed footage of him saying he was pro-choice, followed by footage of him 10 years later saying, I was never pro-choice. Footage of him saying that he was in favour of gun licensing and proper regulations, followed by footage of him a few years later saying, oh, I've always been a hunter. So, that's Romney's problem.
The Iowa caucus hasn't offered any more clarity either, has it? In fact, it's made it even more muddy.
It has.
And he can't get over the 25%.
No, indeed.
He can't get anybody more than 25% of the Republicans to go for him.
Well, and maybe that's all he needs. And we'll see what happens in New Hampshire next week. So obviously there was a bit of discussion in that program about the US presidential elections.
Not just the United States.
But it was all about the Americas, plural. So we went south as well. Yes, we headed south. So we had a good discussion about Brazil and Colombia as sort of two countries really to watch in 2012. And then we even ventured north just a little bit to talk about Stephen Harper in Canada. But it was mainly about Central and South America as well.
And Brazil, when you focused on Brazil, I mean, some people are saying we no longer call it a developing but a developed country. But at the same time, you hear talk about people saying, well, actually, the middle class has risen too quickly and it's going to head to recession again. What was the subject?
Well, look,
there?
I mean, what's fascinating with Brazil is, it has been seen as an emerging market, and yet it's just become the sixth largest economy in the world. So it's obviously not doing badly, and it's overtaken Britain in that respect. The discussion we had was also looking at how Dilma Rousseff has done. She's now 1 year in office. When she came in, she was very much seen as Lula's puppet, or if not a puppet, but at least sort of, she was only there because the previous president, Lula da Silva, had put her there. But she's really sort of come into her own in the past year. She's got rid of six cabinet members, and possibly seven now, for corruption. On one hand, you could say that shows there's a problem with corruption. On the other hand, and this is what Jeffrey Kaufman was saying in the show, it shows that she's taking a very strong line on it.
And when you look at Colombia as well, because, you know, when you think of corruption, unfortunately, that often gets tied in with Colombia. Mm. Was that discussed as well this time around?
Partly, but also just looking at how Juan Manuel Santos, the Colombian president, is trying to build on the legacy of Uribe, the previous president, is sort of striking out in a different direction, more emphasis on social programs that perhaps Uribe didn't have time for or wasn't able to before. And obviously Colombia is, as you know, we've been talking about and writing about for the past year or so in the magazine, is going to be a real key player to watch in Latin America over the next 12 months.
Okay. Steve, where can we find the rest of this global briefing?
You can find them all on iTunes and also monocle.com/24/global-briefings.
Thanks very much for joining us.
I'll come back tomorrow, shall I?
Would you?
Yes. We're talking Africa then.
We'll do Africa tomorrow.
Okay,
we'll do a continent a day until we get bored.
Until we run out of continents.
Until we run out of continents, we'll have done the world in a week. As Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, you're listening to Midori House. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Time now for some music. This is School of Seven Bells and Fuss and Heart is Strange. School of Seven Bells on Monocle 24. It's 19 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
We turn to the world of retail now on Midori House because in continually uncertain economic times, many in the United States believe spending is essential to growth in 2012. Retail makes up 70% of the United States economy, and a pre-Christmas shopping lull saw panicked reductions across stores to get people over the threshold. But will it mean 2012 gets off to a healthy start? Well, to assess the situation, I'm joined by Tom Chin, a retail analyst and managing director of consulting and analytics at Telsey Advisory Group. He joins us on the line now. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Tom. Explain to us how we left, in what state we left 2011 before we move on to this year.
Sure. You know, I think in 2011, what we saw over the holiday period was really a tale of two kind of periods. One, during Black Friday, where we saw a lot of promotional activity really increase the consumer traffic at the malls. And then there was a couple-week lull kind of between Black Friday and 2 weeks preceding the Christmas holidays. But then we saw really a lot of traffic and conversion in terms of people in the stores those 2 weeks right before Christmas. So definitely was very promotional in terms of the discounts you mentioned before, driving the traffic. So I think it's still a bit measured in terms of the consumer out there, but we're glad that at least they are shopping.
So what state does it leave the retail world in the United States? Does it mean that the only way that people are going to get, that retailers are going to get people across the doorstep is to cut prices again and again and again?
I think, you know, clearly this holiday period is traditionally very promotional, so I think that is the backdrop. But I do think that consumers in the U.S. are looking for value. And it may not necessarily mean cheap, but it could be a very high-end product that is at a reasonable price in terms of the eyes of the consumer. I think that value equation will hold into 2012. On the high end, we've seen a lot of actually bounce back from the 2008 recessionary period, where the high end had always had the ability to spend, just not the willingness to. They are out there spending. We're waiting for some of the middle tier, the mid-tier consumer to come back, and they haven't really come back in full force quite yet. Where they have come back is generally, again, around those promotional events.
So the high end remains untouched, but you're talking about the middle ground here. Am I right in thinking that the resources used to pay for all this, all these goods, it is actually a rather dangerous approach? It's actually been done on a rather dangerous way, that consumers are spending their savings and actually going back to the credit card in order to go shopping again?
I don't think there's a wholesale increase in terms of delinquencies and those type of things. I mean, generally, the U.S. consumer has been deleveraging over time, and I think that process will continue. So I don't think that they're out there mortgaging their future in terms of spending now. I think there's always a little bit of noise in terms of those savings rates as it relates to kind of the income part of the equation and how accurate that is. But nonetheless, I don't think that the consumers are out there. I think they do know that, for the most part, that they don't want to see a repeat of what happened in 2008. I think we're seeing positive signs in terms of employment with jobless claims, I think at the lowest level since July of 2008. And all those signs point to a slow and moderate recovery, not obviously V-shaped, nor does it mean that it's a double-dip recession. But I think the consumer is just very, again, promotionally driven and slow. They're not going out and buying full price quite yet. But I don't see them, again, mortgaging the future to spend today.
They're also, however, being pinched from different directions, though, are consumers. I mean, housing prices are still going down. There's still caution in the world of mortgages, and borrowers are now still owing more than their homes are worth. Is that influencing their spending?
Oh, absolutely. I think all those factors are definitely issues the consumer has to deal with. I think on top of that, if you think about longer term, we know that the U.S. deficit has to be dealt with through some type of tax increase or spending decrease, most likely both. And so at some point, that definitely will hit the consumer in terms of their ability and their wallet share to be able to spend on different types of services and products. So I think that's kind of lingering kind of in the longer term. I think in the nearer term, though, looks like the job growth is there. We'll see, kind of for December, if we're going to hit the 200,000 jobs that a lot of the economists are projecting that we are going to get in terms of increase for December. But, there's quite a bit of, headwinds, but I think, again, we're seeing a little bit better picture in terms of employment, which is one of the biggest, catalysts or biggest factors in terms of consumer spending.
To what degree do you think that the forthcoming presidential elections will influence people's spending?
I think generally on a day-to-day basis, no. But I think depending on the, the different approaches in terms of taxes, in terms of other, fiscal policy, I think will have some impact. Again, whoever is going to be the, in the executive office for the next 4 years. So, I think, the stock markets, generally there's a lot of analysis done when Republicans come in or Democrats, what have you, incumbents versus, the challengers. But, I think on a day-to-day basis, it's going to be about, what happens with taxes, what happens to spending, and generally if the employment picture picks up and things that we can do or the government can do to impact that, I think will be the most telling. But we will have to wait and see until, November comes.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. That was Tom Chin, the Managing Director of Consulting and Analytics at Telsey Advisory Group, giving us a forecast for the retail world in the United States for 2012. Well, coming up in the next half hour, we'll be hearing about this year's trends on the world catwalk. But to take us into the news at the bottom of the hour, here's a bit more music. Ordinary by Tuomo. What happens if I fail? And that was Ordinary by Tuomo. You're listening to Midori House. It's 30 minutes past the hour. Time now for a catch-up on the news headlines. Here's Christian Yeo.
Thank you. The Iraqi Shia militia group, Asaib al-Haq, says it's prepared to lay down its arms and join the political process. The group's leader claims the resistance to foreign occupation is now over, now that allied troops have left the country. The militia says it's willing to hand over the remains of a British bodyguard taken hostage in 2007. It comes as at least 68 people are killed in bomb attacks in southern Iraq and Baghdad. Officials say 44 people died in a suicide attack targeting Shia pilgrims in Nazariya. A further 24 were killed in blasts in Shia areas of Baghdad this morning. A teenage widow in Oklahoma who shot dead an intruder who was in her home on New Year's Eve is to face no charges. 18-year-old Sarah McKinley was alone with her newborn baby when two men tried to break in. Burma's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says her party has been approved to take part in the upcoming by-election. The democracy campaign has been in detention for more than 15 years after coming into conflict with the ruling military regime. International Airlines Group, the company formed by the merger of British Airways and Iberia, has posted a strong rise in traffic last month. IAG said its first and business class travel, the most profitable part of its passenger business, rose 13.6%, whilst non-premium traffic was up 12%. And General Motors says it's developed a proposed fix to the battery pack for the Chevrolet Volt to eliminate the risk of a fire being triggered days after a crash. GM said it would strengthen the battery and prevent coolant fluid from leaking. It's understood the fix would cost the company around $1,000 per vehicle, or just under $9 million in total. And those are the stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Christian. And Christian will be back in a little under half an hour with a full roundup of the world's news. But next here on Midori House, we turn to the world of books. Because this week, Monocle 24 has been looking to the year ahead and asking leading figures from the industries of business, media and design about their hopes and their predictions and their fears for 2012. To guide us through the next 12 months of books, I'm very pleased to say I'm joined in the studio by the Booksellers Features and Supplements Editor, Tom Tom, I can't even say your name. Let's try and get this
Tom's
right.
Fine.
Tom, can we stick with Tom? Yes. Otherwise, we're going to be in trouble. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Very simple question at the moment. What are you reading at the moment?
I've just started reading this book called Conquest by Stuart Binns, which is a rip-roaring blood and guts saga of the Norman invasion. Blood spewing and gore.
And is blood spewing and gore a common theme that we're going to be seeing in books for 2012, or what other themes are you picking up?
Actually, there are some blood and guts coming in, particularly with Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall follow-up, which is called Bring Up the Bodies. If you remember Wolf Hall, which won the Booker Prize in 2000, a couple of years ago, it was quite gory and quite true to the details of the Tudor period. And also, along the same lines, but not as gory, but more bodily fluids, is
right.
Urban Wealth. Urban Wealth was
scatological section that's going to be soon appearing in every bookshop.
Yeah.
There's a prequel to Trainspotting.
A prequel to Trainspotting to show you how the characters got on drugs.
I was going to say, how do we contemplate the lives of such sort of destroyed characters?
Yeah.
They're destroyed by the time they get to the book, to Trainspotting.
Yes,
so is this going to be all just lovely, lovely sort of stories of people just gently descending into chaos?
Gently and not so gently, I think.
Right.
Mark Renton, the main character in the Trainspotting, has a university place and his life is great and he's going places and then gets hooked on Skag, which the title's called Skag Boys.
Right, Skag Boys. What else? This is obviously a prequel. I mean, this is a little bit like the book world going to, you know, following in the steps of Hollywood just to try and to lure people in. Is this recession driven again?
I would say.
Sorry, I'm being cynical.
No. Irvin Welsh has revisited these characters before. He did a sequel called Porno a few years ago. I think basically a lot of publishers are going for safe bets. Things that will get the cash registers ringing or the internet downloads going. Another one is probably a till. One that will go through the tills is Andrew Motion's Silver, which is a sequel to Treasure Island. Andrew Motion, of course, the
former poet laureate. Branching into full-length fiction.
Yes. It'll be fun. It'll be big big sellers.
Have you had any looks at any of these books yet, or do you just get a little crib sheet from them?
Some of them. I've seen the Irvin Welsh
book. What's that? And so, but you haven't seen the Andrew Motion one or the Hero?
No, I've seen a few blurbs from it, but nothing. Nothing. Not the full.
Something to look forward to. I mean, is there any interest? What's the appetite for these books at the moment?
The Irvin Welsh book? Or the, I'm not sure about the Irvin Welsh book because it's been a long time since Trainspotting. And I don't know if he's, I won't say he's past it, but revisiting these characters shows some sort of stunting of creativity, maybe, if that's not too harsh. Mm. But maybe he will reinvent them again. But I think there is definitely for the Wolf Hall and for Silver, there's a big appetite for historical fiction at the moment.
Right. Speaking of historical fiction, we have, not necessarily historical fiction, but we have big events coming up this year in 2012, which we're obviously trying to sort of create history before it even happens.
Yeah.
How is the book world reflecting that?
Well, there's three huge events in the book world where hundreds, literally hundreds of books are being published. The Olympics, the Diamond Jubilee, and the Titanic anniversary, the 100th anniversary, which I guess is history.
Yes.
The Olympics are a huge, huge bet for the publishers. It's interesting because, you know, they've got a small window, and once the final bit of the games is gone, they're not going to sell any
you're
books.
Done. Yeah. With something as big as the Olympics, what kind of book sells? Is it the sort of the generic history of Olympics book, or is it the little quirky things that people always find, you know, tickles their fancy about a certain subject?
I think there are safe bets with sort of big commemorative editions, you know, the pictures of the Olympic Games, that sort of thing. But the quirky ones, I think, are quite good sellers because a lot of times these are bought or created with not much, you know, advance or any money beforehand. There's an interesting one coming out called The Secret Life of an Olympian, which is by Anonymous, but supposedly a former Olympian, which he dishes the dirt on how drugs treat cheats are in the Olympics and that sort of thing.
Right.
A no-holds-barred sort of thing. And then I got a book today, actually, called Knit for Gold.
Sorry, hang on. Say that again.
Knit for Gold.
Oh, why didn't you bring it in, Tom?
Because it's mine.
Okay, well, we'll fight over it. Go on, tell me what it's about.
It's a craft book that tells you how to knit your favorite athletes. So if
you knit your favorite athletes?
Usain Bolt, you can knit Usain Bolt.
If you're quick enough.
Yeah.
My Lord, I'm getting thumbs up from the control room. They all want a copy of Knit for Gold. I think that's something that we'll have to get in on Monocle 24. So basically, it is pretty much anything goes now. If you can try and ally anything to the Olympics, then you might be able to basically make a tiny little bit of money out of this. Right. You know, is there any cultural worth in many of these books?
Some of them are. I think there's a lot of nice art books or photography books, I should say, coming out.
Mm.
One by John Wiley, which I've had a look at, which is a really lovely, quite pricey, about £75, I think, coffee table book, which is brilliant.
Worth getting. So we've talked about the Olympics, and then we briefly mentioning the Titanic. And then, I mean, what is there left to be said about the Titanic? Or is it just reissuing old stuff?
There are a lot of reissues. In a normal year, there's probably about 30, 40 books published on the Titanic.
Right.
But this year, of course, is the 100th anniversary, and there's, like the Olympics, everything from glossy coffee table books to new fiction about the Titanic. I got one today again, which is a sort of, not by Mills and Boone, but a Mills and Boone-esque romance called Fateful.
James Cameron should make a film about that. He didn't do too badly on it.
Hmm.
So it was what it was. It's a Mills and Boone style
romance based on the Titanic.
My goodness, right. Yeah. Let's look ahead as well. This last year, I think I got very into short stories. I don't know why. It's possibly my brain shrank, so my concentration went. Are there a lot of short stories to be out there? Is this a resurgent market?
Yeah, it's funny you say that about your brain shrinking. There is a theory that because of digital and how we read shorter now, that short stories will become more popular. And in fact, a lot of publishers have come out with ebook-only short story collections that Random House and Penguin and Penn Macmillan have come out. And not only that, there's actual books, physical books being published on this.
Still?
Yeah, still, amazingly. and ones I could big up, as the kids say. Nathan Englander, who's an American despite his name, he's coming out with a short story collection, which is excellent. I've read a lot of the stories. Lucy Wood, who she's a young British writer whose stories are kind of Cornish mysticism in modern day. It's much better than it sounds, but yeah, she's
Tom,
really good.
Tom, I can't wait to read that. And one day, will you promise to come back into Monocle 24 and bring in just the books you'd received that day?
Yes.
Because if you've got Knit for Gold, I think you'll be rugby tackled at the door. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Tom Tivenin from Booksellers.
Thank you.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture, and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
Minutes to the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be talking about what to look forward to in 2012 in the world of fashion. But to take us there, some music, Licka Lee and I Follow Rivers. And that was Licky Lee and I Follow Rivers. It's 14 minutes to the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. And now we turn from what we were talking about a moment ago, the world of books, to the world of fashion. And Sarah Moer is a renowned writer whose contributions to Vogue have made her one of the most recognisable faces in the front row of any show across the globe. Her talents have even caught the Queen's attention, having been awarded for an MBE for her services to the industry last year. A constant champion of British talent, I'm very pleased to say she joins us live in the studio now to talk about 2012's major trends. Sarah, a very warm welcome to Midori House.
Thank you for having me.
Where do we leave fashion in 2011 and where's it going to go in 2012? Let's address the first half of that
question. Well, I do think that, we're hitting quite gloomy times and fashion will, I hope, step up to the plate and be something, which it should be... always, which is a vehicle for cheering ourselves up.
Yeah, it's the ultimate diversion.
It's
isn't
looking
it?
On the bright side.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I think it's really fascinating seeing how the designs for spring summer 2012 differed from the ones which were around at the last crash was happening in 2008. The reaction then was for designers to become very safe and classic and
very understated.
And very understated, minimalist, and everything was beige.
Right.
Which was a sort of stiffening up, being sensible reaction. And now we're seeing so much colour and so much print and embroidery and jewellery. It's almost as if the whole of the body of fashion have thought, well, you know, damn it, we've got to just brazen this out and be as cheerful as we possibly can about it.
It's the equivalent of sticking your fingers in your ears and shouting la la la, isn't it, as the world falls around.
Yeah, I think
you.
it can be rather brave. It doesn't mean you have to spend a lot of money on these things. You can just sort of stick on a pair of chandelier earrings and wear them during the day.
It'd be brilliantly edited, which is what everybody does, boy, man and woman.
Why not?
I mean, just flicking through the magazines in the last couple of months, you see the resurgence of, dare I say it, pastels. And that's such a brave area to go into, boy or girl.
I don't think that's difficult at all. I think colour in general doesn't have to be pastel. I mean, there are neons, there are incredibly bright primaries. I think you can mix and play with those things. And I think it's very influenced by movements like the postmodernist movement, which has been showcased in that exhibition at the
V&A.
Memphis Design and so on. And what seemed sort of outlandish only a year ago, the idea that, you know, men and women would wear, say, red trousers or green trousers, yeah, has become a major
that
trend.
That was a big thing in the autumn 2011,
and it's carrying
wasn't
on.
It?
It's carrying on. It's
so that will take
surprise.
Us. We can still keep our red trousers going.
Yes.
That's very reassuring to know. I'm so pleased. Then you were talking about the fact that style and colour is a statement to be made during a recession. Mm. What about the things that people are buying? I mean, the high-end market, I'm assuming, is not remotely being touched by the recession. But the day-to-day purchases of lots of people surely still are being squeezed.
They're being very squeezed. But I think what's interesting is that there's a sort of high-end, low-end meeting in products like nail polish. You'll see that girls now collect Dior nail polishes and Chanel, the latest Chanel colours, and, you know, they're decorating their nails in such extraordinary ways, different colour for each digit.
Well, they're fetishising nail polish as well, because for about 12 months, I think, there was this thing that whenever the latest Chanel nail polish came out, it was gone before it came out.
It's continuing. It's really going to continue. And there'll be, you know, there are things like little silver pens that you can draw on your nails with, and so on. I think it's part of the way that you know, girls can have access to a designer name, and I, you know, I don't disapprove of it, because it's creative. It's actually doing something.
But it also
too.
Keeps designers absolutely in the forefront of everybody's bathroom, which is something that is quite extraordinary in the middle of a recession.
Yes, it is, and you will see that you know, young girls, even girls who are out sort of earning their basic living, want to aspire to a Chanel handbag. Yeah.
And when you talk about people sort of doing stuff at home and drawing on their own nails, is this just teenagers, or is every man, woman, and girl supposed to be now drawing on their nails?
I think it's something that teenagers are doing now.
They always
and I
did.
Think it will go up, and it will flow upwards. I mean, now I see grandmothers wearing black nail polish, which started off as a sort of goth trend 10 years ago. So all things are possible.
Mm. Last year, very much the focus in the fashion world turned to the United Kingdom.
Yes,
with one big event and one big designer, and, you know, Sarah Burton suddenly blazed a trail for the United Kingdom fashion in a way that I think probably took quite a lot of people by surprise. How much is that going to continue into this year, or has Britain's star burned a bit too brightly?
It's going to be even stronger this year, because it's the year of 2012. The entire world's going to be looking at us. It's the Queen's Jubilee. I expect that Catherine Middleton will be wearing, the Duchess of Cambridge, we must call her now, will be wearing more McQueen and more young designers. And Samantha Cameron is there as an ambassador for the British Fashion Council as well. And I think that it's a time when we have a whole, you know, tranche of young designers who've now stepped up to the plate and are selling around the world, and will be even more visible this time. So I'm expecting it, to, you know, London to be the creative capital of the world. And I never thought I would actually, you know, be able to put my hand on my heart and say that sincerely, because we've been the underdog for so many years.
Well, as the British Fashion Council's ambassador for emerging talent, when you spot someone, how do you ensure that they get an outlet nowadays, that they get exposure?
Well, the British Fashion Council now, we have a scheme called the New Generation Scheme, which has actually been going for more than a decade, sponsored by Topshop. In fact, there are going to be celebrations of that 10 years coming up in February. We make sure that designers don't try to run before they can walk. We help them source manufacturers. We help them with sponsors. We introduce them to buyers in Paris. We had to take them to Paris. And this last season in the autumn, we took them to Hong Kong for a showroom to sell as well. So we're taking the designers to the market now.
That's a very good idea. Now, you were talking about Paris just then. excuse me, the great story that emerged from Paris last year was the fall of Galliano. Mm-hmm. Since March, there's been no great
still
permanent
replacement.
What's happening there? Because you hear Marc Jacobs, Jacobs is in the picture, then he's not.
Marc Jacobs is definitely bowed
definitely
out.
Gone. Who is now the front runner for it, or is there still uncertainty?
Mentioned in dispatches is Raf Simons.
Who's
at Jill Sander, yes. So, I mean, I don't know. It's almost, we're getting Dior fatigue now. It's been so many. I think many designers must be feeling very cautious and perhaps intimidated about following such a big name. It's a massive job, and it's a very, very difficult the difficult shoes to fill.
It's a subject matter that was sort of quite in the headlines in about September, and then it's really sort of gone away, and lots of the fashion press don't really talk about it anymore. Why is it not?
Well,
really,
I think we have very short attention spans in fashion. It's become boring. I do know that at the end of January, at the end of this month, there is going to be a Dior couture show, but it's only going to be in the House of Dior. It's not on a big Bill Gayton.
Bill Gayton's going to be doing it. Who hasn't shone at all? He's kept everything afloat.
Yes, it's an incredibly difficult task to step from the background into the foreground. It's not, you know, and that just makes us think even, you know, to be even more impressed by what Sarah Burton did when Alexander McQueen killed himself. She did step seamlessly into the forefront, but. Bill Gayton has been a loyal pattern cutter for all these years at the House of Dior, and a team player.
So very briefly, who do you think might get the Galliano position, the Dior position?
I have no inside information, but the latest...
No, but you're feeling.
They have to find somebody. They have to find somebody who's going to be capable of doing ready-to-wear and... haute couture, it's very difficult. I mean, Raf Simons doesn't have any experience in haute couture, but he's a very strong designer, but very clean. He's not a frilly designer in the way that you would think that Dior, the template set by Dior and Galliano. So maybe it'll be a clean slate, and Raf Simons will step in there. He's a very, very decent designer, so who knows?
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. That was Sarah Murr there. Well, we're out of time for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. Today's programme was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Steve Bloomfield and Andrew Muller will bring you The Monocle Daily in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours London time. We're back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Headlines are next, but first, a song. This is Holy Ghost, Say My Name. I'm Emma Nelson. Goodbye.